Thank you, Brother Craig. Good morning, brothers and sisters. I have to start this morning by taking slight issue with Brother Craig over a small matter which appears in the Sierra Times. The summary says, let's get our lives focused on the things that really matter. You heard that, didn't you? Get our lives focused on the things that really matter. And then he puts the most blurred photograph that he could find of me under those words. Come to New Zealand sometime, my friend.
I thought it was
Ha! Sledgehammer stuff. Yeah. So I borrowed that from Brother Ann.
I'll repay it. Thank you for that.
Focused on the truth at work. I'm going to start by making some assumptions. I'm going to assume that we have all read what the scriptures say in the many places where the scriptures say about work and working conditions. We could attack this from any number of different ways. We can talk about the examples of people who were servants in the Bible, Joseph, Daniel, the Apostle Paul. We often think of him as being a working person, but he was. We could think of people such as Hagar, the experiences that she had and the attitude that she took to those experiences. We could do this from the point of view, as you see, of practical examples. We could think perhaps of the little servant girl who steered Naaman the Syrian to salvation, more than healing, the salvation, wasn't it? We could think of all those practical examples. We could attack this subject from the point of view that we are all servants to the ecclesia and consider our workmanship in the meetings. We could do that. We could read what the scriptures say on the face of the page about our attitude in our work. Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and singleness of your heart as unto Christ, not with eye service as men pleases, but as the servants of Christ. I have a key verse here that goes alongside this. With goodwill doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever any man does, the same he shall receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free. Not that that verse there, or the one that I just read, which is equivalent to it from Ephesians chapter 6, is actually telling us that we ought to work, honestly and reliably at work, so that we will be in the kingdom. It's not really the point. I mean, it's not a quid pro quo arrangement, is it? Basically, we are to think of ourselves as servants to the Lord in whatever we do. And I kind of like the little picture that went with this, and I found it myself a bit of a challenge. And much of what I'm going to say this morning, I want you to understand, has been personally for me a pretty heavy challenge, especially in the latter years, as I've seen the system for which I've been working going down a path with which I didn't agree. The philosophy and the direction of this path was just completely foreign to me, and I found it increasingly difficult to show the sort of willing spirit of cooperation which we have here in the little cartoon fellow up there. And so we have all these scriptures, and there's lots of them. There's the one that we read, Ephesians chapter 6. There's a very similar statement there in Colossians chapter 3. As you know, Ephesians and Colossians are just about mirror images of each other in their treatment of the subject matter. We find it in the Old Testament. Psalm 123 says, behold, as the eyes of servants look unto the hand of their masters, and as the eyes of a maiden unto the hand of her mistress, so our eyes wait upon the Lord our God until that he have mercy upon us. And what he's saying there, of course, the psalmist is saying that the attitude that a good servant has to his master or mistress, as the case may be, is the attitude that the servant of God should have towards the Lord. And of course, the flip side of that is that if we have a relationship with God, which is satisfactory and productive and will bring us into the kingdom, then that's the attitude that we ought to have to our earthly masters. And that's, let me tell you, that is one challenge. Well, that is a tough call. And I've got to say that there have been times when I've been aware in myself that I haven't measured up to that, and I've not been particularly proud of myself in that regard. Brother John briefly alluded this morning, saying, you know, as he reflects upon his life and as he thinks of who he is with the particular knowledge that he has of himself, and we all know what he's talking about, then he wonders at the grace of God. Well, this has been for me a particularly I'm not leaning on John there, I'm identifying with him, you understand, but it's been a particular challenge to me in the matter of work, you know, because there have been times when I haven't been entirely comfortable with what I've been doing. And if we happen to be in positions of authority, as many brethren are in very, very many places, the scriptures say, you know, examples. I am a man under authority, said the centurion. I'm a man under authority. What a fantastic attitude that is, you know, to think of the authority as himself being subject to it, rather than as some sort of petty tyrant building his own empire or whatever, exercising authority over others. He sees himself as one who is under authority. And so it goes. Well, I've got two pages of quotations which I've extracted, and you know them, and we're going to take them as read. I'm assuming that we have that in the back of our minds as we go through. And what I would like to do is just simply light discussion, effectively. Just discuss this question and the problems which may come up. Now, the first thing I'd like to do is just present a few statistics. These are my calculations. There is no particular authority for them. What I've done is I've just sat down and I've thought about it and said, well, now let's take a hypothetical average Christadelphian, or average person for that matter. If you live for 75 years, that turns out to be 657,450 hours. And when you put it like that, it makes you think that perhaps we ought to do something with these hours, because let me tell you that it's a big number, but they tick off. They tick off. We spend about 13% of our lives at work on the basis of the following assumptions. First of all, we're working 9 hours per day, which includes commuting. Some more, some less, but let's take an average of about 9 hours a day. 5 days a week, we work 48 weeks a year. We're going to have 4 weeks vacation. For 40 years, say, that's 86,720 hours which we devote to our working lives. Okay? That works out at 13% of our total lifetime. Now, if you take out of that the period which most of us would regard as sort of preparation for that, say the first 15 years, now for most of it's more than that, but let's say the first 15 years of our life are just in preparation for our adulthood, then the time that we devote to work, those 86,000 odd hours, come out at 16% of our total lifetime. Right? And then if we take into account that most of us sleep now and again, and I hope nobody's sleeping right at the moment, but if we take into account the fact that most of us sleep, say 6.5 hours a day, personally I sleep more than that, then that makes the percentage of our lifetime that we devote to our work even greater. It's coming up near 25%. Coming on for a quarter of our total human experience under the sun is devoted to making a living one way or another. Now, I'm averaging that out, and I'm not taking into account the fact that sisters don't go to work. As a matter of fact, I think the sisters do a lot more work than that. This is the bare bones of it. You can hardly do less than this. And these days, you know that a lot of people work for a lot more than the 40 years that I've assigned here. Quite a number work for a good deal more than 48 weeks a year, if they've got their own business and so on. And many people devote far more than the 9 hours per day that I've allocated there. So 23% seems to be a bare minimum of our life that we devote to our working lives. And I guess that these days especially, there's a good deal more that's given to it, as you know. So the figures are conservative. Obviously then, the whole point of this, we've got to pay attention to what we're doing when we're at work. Just pay a little attention to it, because it's obviously a significant part of our total human experience. So the question then arises, why should we go to work? Why work? What do we
hope to achieve from it?
Well, it depends on your attitude. If you look around, you find people have all kinds of reasons for going to work. Some people live to work. Just look at the way in which those two first lines interact. You can do this, you see. You can basically say, well, here I am, and my function is to work. And for most people, most of my colleagues, for example, that was the thing. They regarded themselves as finding their fulfillment and their reason for being in their work. And one of the things that I found was a matter of, not exactly conflict, but a bit of perhaps marginal friction, was that I never had that attitude towards my work. As far as I was concerned, it was a question of working to live. And if anybody ever asked me, I would say, well, really, my main reason for being here is to put a meal on the table for my family and to survive in this life, you know, just in a mechanical sense. And I really never had much more of a vocation than that. And that was my personal attitude. It may not be yours. And as I said, this is a discussion, and there may be things that I will say that you'll find perhaps a little outrageous or at least challenging. That's fine. Well, I hope it is. We can agree to differ over some things, but personally I think that we as Christadelphians, who do everything so as to live, should put our work into the same category. It's my opinion, and much of what I'm going to say today has to be opinion, as indeed in the rest of the week. So although there's no reason why we shouldn't enjoy our jobs and choose jobs which are congenial to us and which we have an interest, I think we need to keep that under control. My main interest when I was young was electronics. I was absolutely consumed by it. Ever since the age of about 2 or 3, I remember my mother had a sewing machine or something plugged into the power outlet on the stove, and I was young enough to have to stand on my tiptoes, put one hand on the metal frame of the stove to balance myself, and wiggle this plug out, and somehow or other I got my fingers on the other side of it. And what happened to me, it blew a fuse or something. I was just obsessed with electrical things and electronics from then on, and I worked in electronics for quite a while. Until at about age 29, I'd been working there, I suppose, 12 years or so. There was a need to go to a smaller ecclesia, and I had to throw it in, the electronics. I went to a small town, and I started teaching. I got on the telephone, and I rang the secondary schools, said, here I am, this is my background, I think I could teach. I don't know, but I think I could teach. I've got a job, and I was in the same school until I retired at the end of last year. So the job was just simply a means to make a living. I was never really committed to teaching as a vocation. Now, I think that if you can find a job that you enjoy, that's great. But we also need sometimes to think that there are more important issues than just simply the enjoyment of the job. Teaching turned out to be excellent because after the first 2 or 3 years getting organised in the subject, I could go home when the kids went home. Because I used the time that was there, and lunch hours doing the marking and all the rest of it, and the odd free time that was given, I was able to just simply knock off and the bell went and go home and get on with other things. Building buses, apart from anything else. You know, that sort of thing. And furthermore, and much more importantly, there were 12 weeks of paid leave every year. And this was invaluable for the work of the truth. And it was the reason I chose it in the end. I mean, in a sense, I'd worked through the obsession with electronics. I'd gone as far as I reasonably could go, and from then on it was going to be more of the same, and I could see that. So when the call came to go to another ecclesia to do ecclesial work, well, that was the thing which counted. And for 28 years, I did a job in which I really had no tremendous interest. I wasn't really a devoted teacher, you see. Now, I'm not putting myself forward as an example. I'm just simply saying that there is a point of view about that. You know, and if I use anecdotal stuff and it involves me, I'm not proud of what I've done or anything like that, and I'm not putting forward from that point of view. Just simply to discuss the thing and let you see that there are points of view. I mean, you may already have come to these conclusions. I expect that most of you have. So, whatever the thing, if we find fulfillment in our jobs, that's great. But there is a trap in that, and that is, and we see this very often, especially with jobs which have got tremendous fascination, endless interest. You know, I could imagine that getting involved in, now I've got to get it, right? Computer business and that sort of thing, there is a danger in it. It can take us away. It can consume us. We can get immersed in it so deeply that the things of the truth drift away, you know, and that's really the point of this discussion. Because, you see, our prime goal is always to manifest Christ. Not just to know about it and attend the meetings, but to show forth the Lord in our lives. That's what we have to do, not just in the 23% that we're at work, but at all the times. That's our goal, that's our objective, you see. And if we take on a job which consumes our life and takes our interest to the exclusion of everything else, well then of course we put that at risk, don't we?
And of course that naturally raises the next question. Just exactly how do we go about witnessing to the Lord? Witnessing is one form of manifesting Christ. It's not the only form by any means. Manifesting Christ is basically living Christ's life, isn't it? But part of that is to witness to the Lord at work.
Now, I have to tell you that I have always found this the most challenging thing. There are some brethren who just naturally are able to discuss and to lay out the truth in a simple kind of way before anybody. I think of a brother who's well known in Texas. His name just escapes me for the moment, but it'll come to me if anybody's interested. But he'd been to a Bible school, he'd been teaching, and he came back with the Bible school t-shirt. He was wearing it. He got into an aeroplane, and he was sitting, you know, there in the aeroplane, about four rows down, and on the other side there was a fellow who turned around and saw the t-shirt, and he said, what is Christadelphia? You know. And so our brother, you know, well, I mean, how do you talk in an aeroplane down four rows? I mean, yeah, well, Christadelphians are, you know, and away he went. And these two carried it on over this flight, you know, and it lasted for about an hour, and the whole plane got it. You know. And when the plane landed, that was the end of the conversation, as you can understand. But as he was walking out, another fellow in another seat who had said not word one on this conversation stood up and he said, I am very interested in this. He said, I want to hear more about this. So I live in the next state. Can you come and visit us? And as a result of that conversation, which just sprang up like that under the most unlikely circumstances, there is now an ecclesia in the state, in the United States, where there wasn't one before. And this is acting as a nucleus for the growth of the truth. And that same brother does something at work which just blows my mind. He's an executive in this company. He's got status and position in the company. And at lunchtimes, he goes into a corner of the staff room and he has a Bible study that he invites people to. And they come, and there are baptized people coming out of this. And he's got that ability. It's a fantastic ability. I mean, it's tremendous. He's got the personality for it. And he's got the words, and he's just got that nice, easy, relaxed way of doing things. Which I have to tell you, I personally found it very difficult to witness to the truth. I'm the sort of person, I have to tell you, that of whom somebody once said, you ask him the time and he tells you how to make a watch. I tend to lecture people, you know. And there's nothing that kills it so thoroughly stone dead, you know, as a lecture sometimes. And so there are some natural talents and skills in this, and we don't all share them. But whether we have the talent or not, we still are expected to do some witnessing at work. Now, I've looked inside myself and asked the question, why is it that I dodged the witnessing when sometimes it came up? And then over the years, as there always are, there are marvellous opportunities, and I have to tell you that this is another thing of which I'm not particularly proud. I have frequently dodged the issue. And the reasons are, first of all, that I'm conscious that most of my colleagues are totally and absolutely and utterly and profoundly irreligious. And for them, religion is offensive. They will talk about sport till the kingdom comes, and they probably will. Kingdom comes soon. But they won't touch word one on religion. And if you start saying, well, actually, I see this from a different point of view, then they get kind of edgy and irritable, and the trouble is, and I pick up on that, I feel sensitive to it, and I don't like offending people, you see. and this puts me on edge, and then I can't find the words to ease the edginess, if you know what I mean. Now, that has been a problem to me, and I guess it's a problem to a lot of us. Secondly, we're aware that we're employed to do the job, and to spend time talking about the truth while you're doing the job is somewhat impinging on the boss's time, if you know what I mean. And so that has an inhibiting effect on us also. The whole tone of the workplace. You know, especially as a school teacher, I think that you have to be something of a play actor or something. When I began teaching, I was very much aware of this. I would go into the school and suddenly I would pull on a different hat and I would march forth resolutely to do the school teacher thing. You know, and it's quite a different... We're different people in the ecclesia and at home from what we are at work sometimes. I think that's true. I was aware of it. I was conscious of it. It may have been the nature of the job and the fact that I wasn't naturally sort of, into that sort of thing. I had to put on a different facade, almost a mask, you see, and to become a different person. And so the tone of the workplace can inhibit it. It can be a problem. Something to think about. But when I boiled it all down and looked inside myself, basically the reason I don't rise to the occasion of witness when I ought to is because I'm afraid. And there are several things of which I'm afraid. And I have to just share this with you, and I think that maybe we can just look inside ourselves. First of all, we're afraid of being ridiculed to our faces. Now, that hardly ever happens, as a matter of fact. People will be very polite, so... But we know that as soon as we turn our backs, then they're going to talk about us behind their backs, and we are sensitive to that and we don't like it. None of us like that, do we? Okay? So we're sensitive about being laughed at behind our backs. But the other thing which I have found tremendously inhibiting is the fear that they're going to scoff at the word. I don't actually care so much if they scoff at me. But I do care about the word, and that is something which is very dear to me. More important, I think, than anything else. And I've found that that has inhibited me to some extent. Now, of course, the answer to all of this is to have enough faith to just go ahead and do it, of course. And there are all kinds of strategies which we can adopt and just rely on faith and the Lord doing this for us and so on. We all have to come to terms with it. But I always feel that the easiest way to begin to deal with a problem is to identify it, first of all, and to put the problem up there and say, yeah, I know what is bugging me about this. Now, let's see if we can find ways of dealing with it. And the way we deal with it is going to differ from person to person, isn't it? We're not all going to find the same solution. Because, like personalities, solutions differ from circumstances and individuals, whoever's involved are doing it. And yet, in spite of the inhibitions, witness we must. The scriptures have a lot to say about it, don't they? And here are a couple of scriptures. We strictly charge you not to teach in this name, they said to the apostles. You fill Jerusalem with your teaching and you intend to bring this man's blood upon us. Well, says Peter, we must obey God rather than men. And he told us to go preach, so preach we will. And you can't stop us, effectively. Well, now, that to some extent applies to us as well. We have a mandate along the same sort of lines, don't we? I also speak of thy testimonies before kings, says the psalmist, and shall not be put to shame. And that addresses the issue of fear, doesn't it? I'm not going to be put to shame. Why? Because even if they shame me now in this life, they can't touch the life to come. There's nobody can get anywhere near that. And the Lord is in control of that. In your hearts, reverence Christ as Lord, and always be prepared to make a defence to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that's in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. And that is a challenge for me. The gentleness and the reverence. Because we get defensive. I've got a famous atheist colleague. I mean, he came along to a debate that we held in our hall just a few days before he came away. I invited him to come along, but it was rather interesting. You know, when they signed that peace treaty on the... and the lawn of the White House, Arafat and the Israelis, you know. He came in with the headline, And I was sitting at one end of the table in the staff room, and all my colleagues around about, you know, and they all knew what I stood for and that. And he held up his headline and he smiled at me and he said, "So much for Armageddon," you know. And when they signed this thing, you know, because he knew what we believed. And he had me on all the time. You see, now, you get a little defensive about that, and it's possible to come back with a snappy reaction, you see. And once again, when my tendency is to pin him to the wall, I have to learn to back off. Gentleness and reverence, that's the key to it, isn't it? Yeah, there's a bit of a challenge there, isn't it? You think about all of this. It's not really all that straightforward. It needs to be thought about a bit. And I don't have any magic answers. I don't believe there are any magic answers to this. I think that we just generally got to wrestle with it as best we can. The other thing to remember is this question of manifesting Christ as being our purpose and goal. And the old saying that actions speak louder than words, and that's perfectly true. And once again, I have to tell you I'm not that proud of myself in this regard, because there are times when I get so consumed by the thing which is in front of me that I forget the overall picture. And I start going down a track which I later regret. The picture up there is of Noah building the ark, and the relevance of that is in the fact that Noah is set forth as a preacher of righteousness, as you remember, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Now what it says here in Hebrews chapter 11 about Noah is that by faith Noah, being warned by God concerning events which as yet are unseen, he took heed and he constructed an ark for the saving of his household, and by this he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness. Now, what that's saying is that Noah was a preacher of righteousness, but he did his preaching as much by the way in which he lived his life, and what he did with his life is one who built a bus, I can tell you. You spend a fair bit of time doing that sort of thing. Well, I did build an ark, but his ark was a good deal bigger than my bus, and at least I had power tools. So he must have spent a large percentage of his life building that ark. And in that process, he preached. Right? And so, the challenge, I guess, for us is to live our lives, work our work, so that we are an example of the believers. And there are other examples there too. Let your speech be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. And so, you know, just look at that. So that you may know how to answer, how you ought to answer. And so it goes on. The Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kindly, and so on. I'm going to turn this off for a minute. I've got a couple of things which I'd just like to discuss without slides. They were a bit hard to put on the slides. Another thing which bothered me a little bit was a question of accommodation to the world. I'm looking for page 8, and I have it. There's a serious risk, as it seems to me, if we are at risk anywhere, we're at more risk of accommodating to the world at work than we are anywhere else. That's a generalisation, a sweeping statement, may not always be true, but I think it's generally true. First of all, there are pressures on us if we are in an ordinary sort of workplace to conform to the social environment. The staff of the school where I worked for 28 years formed a kind of an extended family. It was, in a sense, their ecclesia, if you know what I mean. And they would get together, they would drink together, they would dine out together, they would go to barbecues together, they would party together, they would play sport together. They did all these things together. And most of them had attitudes and forms of behaviour that, as a servant of God, I personally found offensive at a certain level. Their social activities are very time consuming. They were mad on sport and they discussed it endlessly. New Zealanders are at least as addicted to rugby as South Africans. And that's saying something. Do we join in these sorts of discussions? Is this where our real interest is? Question, isn't it? Do we join with the staff in their social activities because we have in the back, do we rationalise it by saying, if I join in with that, I may be able to influence that person, whereas if I stand aside from it, he will ignore me, write me off. Now, that is a real serious issue, because you see, I chose personally the path of isolation, in a sense, separatism. And looking back over 28 years, I'm not sure that it was really altogether wise. I think there could have been a bit more a balance in this, because you see, at the end, I had separated myself so thoroughly from them that they never considered me or included me in anything, and therefore I'd ceased to have any real influence on them. I'm kind of bearing my soul to you, if you know what I mean. And for all of us, we need to find a balance in this somehow, and I'm not sure that the path that I took, although it was taken for what I consider to be the right reasons, and which made me personally more comfortable, because actually I'm not all that sociable. I find myself often most happy when I'm by myself or in my study or something like that. It was a path that was easy for me, and I could easily rationalise and say I ought to be separate from these people. But you know, in the end, I finished up cutting myself off to some extent. And they wouldn't have listened. They would come and ask me questions about religion and so on, but it was just as a source of information, just in the same way as they would come and ask me questions about physics. But there was no real rapport, if you know what I mean. So there is something for us to think about. I think it's important for us when we're starting out in a job to make our place and our path clear in general, then to stick to it, and it's that helps a lot. I think it's much easier for us at the start of a job to say, no, I don't drink. Actually, I don't have any personal objection to alcohol. If somebody offers me wine at a table or anything of that sort, I don't have the least objection to taking it. There's no scriptural principle involved in that. But the staff with whom I worked, having said, no, I don't drink, whenever there was some function that I had to attend, but because it was an official function at the school and there was alcohol there, they never offered me alcohol, and they always expected it would be objectionable to me. And that was interesting. And of course I respected that, because that was their perception of their position, of my position, I'm sorry. Well, there is something to think about. And once again, I'm only raising this in discussion. I don't have any answers, but not really. I have one or two regrets, I have to tell you. But that's history. And if that experience is helpful, well, that's great. Secondly, of course, you can always accommodate to the world in the actual work itself. And I think this is less of a challenge. For example, I was once asked, when I was working in the Department of Scientific Industrial Research before I became a teacher, I was once asked to work on an aero engine from a fighter plane. Now, let's face it, the New Zealand Air Force is kind of Mickey Mouse outfit. I mean, if one aeroplane falls out of the sky, it ain't going to make a whole lot of difference to the balance of power, you understand, you know. Nevertheless, I, you know, again, having sort of taken the position about military matters, I went to the boss and I said, well, now, I have a problem about this. I have a conscientious problem. I explained it. He said, no problem. And reassigned me something else, you see. That was fine. You can do that. But we can sometimes choose questionable work. Now, I've chosen a sort of scientific example, but I'm sure that must be true. Oh, I don't know, law, any number of things you could get involved in, which might be just a little bit on the edge as far as our relationship with the Lord is concerned. Some jobs are quite unsuitable, I suppose. The military is an obvious one. Maybe police, probably police. But political positions. Some brethren, you know, are involved in hospital boards or borough or city councils and so on. There's kind of a grey area there, you know, about the extent to which we should get involved in those sorts of things. You can accommodate to the world in the way you do your job. I've been to one or two staff meetings, for example, where things were getting a little bit warm, a little heated, and then, you know, you are kind of expected to make a contribution, and you get into the verbal stuff, and before long you start listening to yourself and you say, hey, this is not quite the way we ought to be going, right? So, and sometimes it's too late. You're way down the track before you realise what path you're on, I guess. And the other thing, the final thing, which was always a bit of a problem, the boss can expect us to put the job before anything else. And these days, that's becoming a real issue. Somebody in Texas I was talking to, saying that he was expected to work all night. He worked all day, the job wasn't finished, there was a deadline on, and he had to stay there until it was done. And he worked all night. And in the morning he had to sort of direct a few people to, because he was physically falling asleep at that stage, and he just went into a room that was set aside and he slept there, and he didn't go home for 2 or 3 days, and he had a young family. Something wrong with the job he's doing there. Now, I think we're all prepared to pull the stops out when there's a real need and say, right, you know, we've got an urgent job here, let's get into it. But as a regular deal, this is not on, is it? Or at least, that's my opinion. And as I said before, these are very much my opinion. You see, it seems to me that whatever job we do, the most that can be said for it is that it's an adjunct to our lives. Just remember the proposition we started with. Some people have very important jobs and some people have very fulfilling jobs, but the real test of anything is this going to matter in 50 years' time? Even on a human level, in 50 years' time, is it going to matter all that much? Doesn't, you know, you kind of think that what you're doing is important, right? Is it going to make any real difference to anything? And the number of people of whom the answer to that question is yes, it will make a difference in 50 years' time, positive difference, must be very limited worldwide. And I look back on all the things, the thousands of people that I've spoken to and that kind of thing. There has been some positive stuff. I get stopped in the streets from time to time by grateful parents who say, "You turned my son around. He was going nowhere and you gave him a sense of direction." Now that's nice. You know, you look at it and you say, yeah, it was worth doing that. And a staff member at the school came to me and he said, "I was a deadhead and going nowhere." And I knew he was. When he came to the class, he had a reputation. I had inherited this fellow from an earlier level, and he came in and I thought, oh boy, here we go. You know, he's one of those. He had an attitude. And he sat quietly for a start and he listened for a little while. In 3 weeks he was up and running. It redirected him. And instead of going straight into the gutter, he then took on positive jobs. And he came to me when he got a job. He became a trained teacher and chose to come back to the school. And he walked into the staff room and he sought me out and he said, "I'm here because you turned me around." And I wasn't aware of having done anything except just doing what I did with all of them, you know. But that happens. And I suppose in that sense you could say the job does make a difference in 50 years' time. Because it may go on, and this is one of the advantages perhaps of teaching, but I don't really think of it that way at all. I sort of think, well, it doesn't matter, you know, it's just a job. And so I think it's quite good to sort of have that attitude about a job, that it is an adjunct, it's a means of making a living, that's it. What will we think about jobs when we look back on them from the kingdom? Our highest priority is our duty to the Lord, and we must make that clear when we're taking a job. We're going to give value for money, make no mistake about it. I hope I haven't given the wrong impression. As far as I was concerned, when I went in there, I went in crisp, I worked like a dog, I worked hard, right through. And I would go home frequently exhausted at the end of the day, and Cora will tell you that sometimes I would just go and lie down and sleep until dinner time, so I could get up and do something afterwards because I worked hard during the day. One of the nice things about it, one of the tremendous advantages that I found, was that by doing the job and always getting the results they wanted, when it came to special concessions for the truth, the boss was prepared to discuss them. And for 10 years, at least 10 years, every year, when I asked for it, they gave me time off to go to Bible schools and other countries and so on. And the reason for that was, I think, giving value for money. Even though I didn't fit into their social scene and they weren't very comfortable with me because of that, they at least made concessions. And that's important.
and it's possible to gain concessions just by reasonable negotiation. And by showing that the things of the truth are important, then they will frequently concede those sorts of things. Next question I ask is, to what extent should we be the boss or aspire to be the boss? And here's a little thing to think about. Why not? Think of Joseph, virtually the boss of Egypt. Okay? Think of Daniel, who was the boss of Persia, Babylon, Persia. David was the king. Mordecai rose to great power in the Persian system, and so on. No reason at all why we shouldn't be the boss, aspire to be the boss. Yeah, but if you just look at this, very few brethren ever rose to high position. And you just remember that little passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. You see your calling, brethren, not many noble, not many high, and all the rest of it. You remember that? And the nature of the fellowship is such that we are, at the present time, well, the lower strata as far as the movers and shakers in this life are concerned. And the reason for that is clear. It's those who are humbled first who will be exalted later. That's fair enough. But if you look at those biblical men of God who rose to high estate, you will find that in virtually every case, in fact, I can't think, well, you'll come to me with 100 of them later, I guess, but I can't think of a single exception to this proposition. They all had power thrust upon them. Ain't but one of them I can think of that went looking for promotion. They just worked honestly at the level to which they were assigned, and because they worked at it honestly, then they were promoted by their employers in every case. Think of Joseph, you know? Think of Daniel. And in every case, it was their fidelity to the things of God, and by putting the things of God first, that they were promoted to higher places. So maybe we ought to look carefully and think carefully about this notion of looking for promotion as its own case. And but the other thing I should say about this is that the other thing which these brethren had in common was that they got their high position out of a period of tribulation and oppression in many cases, didn't they? So that's something to think about. And also, if you get to be the boss, you may be involved in a whole bunch of things that you'd really rather not be involved in. The social life is one, but the politics of the firm, or whatever it is, should we be comfortable about that? And so we might regard it as inappropriate to seek for promotion beyond a certain level. My opinion, not binding on anybody, just the way that I look at it, after having sort of come out of the end of the process, I suppose, and now reflecting on it. Remember that whatever we do, God is our employer, and I just keep coming back to this theme all the time. Daniel's an example of a very conscientious worker elevated to a high position, yet he politely and resolutely refused to give more than was consistent with his service to God, creating incidental problems like a lion's den. Alright? But he was prepared to pay that price because he saw his work as an adjunct. Basically, he was a servant of God. He was devoted to prayer. He was devoted to the welfare of his people. He turned his face to the wall and he wept when he considered the fact that the promise of Jeremiah, the 70 years before the deliverance, were all but run. And there was no sign that it would be fulfilled. And I have a theory, a hypothesis, that he is the Michael who came to the aid of the angel, that Daniel himself was Michael who helped just in the course of his work, going in to speak to the king. The king wants to do something which God didn't want to have happen, and the angel trying to block this all the time and struggling to do it, so much so that he hadn't got time in 3 weeks to come and answer Daniel's prayer. And finally Daniel comes in with a form to be signed by the king or something. I'm inventing all of this. And he puts the form in front of the king and he says, sign this. The king signs it and hands it back. And Daniel's walking out and he says, Daniel, you've been around for a while. I'm trying to do this, but every time I try to do that, I get blocked. What do you think I should do?
And he turns around, an older man, he's 85 years old, roughly. And he turns to the king and he says, "Well, actually, king, I think you're trying to do the wrong thing. If you ask my advice, my opinion is you should do this." And Lo Michael, one of the chief princes, came to my aid as the angel. And I think that's Daniel, faithfully doing his work. Right? See, his mind was always on the things of God, even when he was at work. And I think that's a tremendously helpful picture. Now, I'm prepared to elaborate it, but not right now, because we haven't really had time. I shouldn't have even mentioned it. The key to Daniel's success: constant contact with God. That's it. He was a man of God first and last, and always. Tremendous example for all of us. Here's something else to think about. A little bit of statistics, something I picked up from Time magazine. I don't read Time magazine unless I happen to go to the doctor or the dentist, but I guess I was at the doctor or the dentist and I picked up Time magazine. I found this interesting statistic. The average term of employment worldwide is 5 years. Now, I can tell you, I've messed that up a little bit because I had two jobs in my life and the last one lasted for 28 years. So I've stacked that average a bit, you know, because of my 28 years of employment in one place. But worldwide today, the average term of employment is 5 years. You know, there's a lot of stories go with this. But a brother in New Zealand who said to me, he's way up in the wool board, which is a big thing in New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand's small, so how big can it be? But it's, for him, this is a significant job. And he's a very accomplished young brother, a good deal younger than I am. He travels the world selling wool all over the place. Australians don't like it too much because they like to sell wool. And he said, yeah, he said, if you... They employ you. You are expected to make changes, but they don't expect you to make any changes after 3 years. If you haven't got the changes made in 3 years, you're not going to do it. 5 years, you're stale, and they've got you on rollers. You're out. You know? And so what they do, they get these young fellows and they put them into these high-pressure jobs, and they're expected to produce. Okay. Another young brother came. He said he'd been in the job and it. And it got to the stage where they, to cut costs, you see, they let people go. And then they pile their jobs onto others who've already got them. You see, now you go and you get a job, you master it, and after a while you can do it more or less automatically, as I did with my job, you see. And you then got time to do something else in your private life, family, and all the other things, leisure, you see. No, they don't do that anymore. What they do is they let the people get in the job long enough to get expert at it, and then they let somebody else go and dump his job on the fellow who's mastered his, because he's got something else to learn, and he then can do two jobs. That's cheaper. They have to pay so much. You've got one bloke doing two jobs. And when he's surrounded there, they let somebody else go and dump something on. Like, but if you're very good at it and very conscientious, they just keep piling the jobs on until something breaks. And do you think they care? They don't care about your family life. I don't care about the ecclesia or your health. I mean, they'll drive this to the limit, you see. And this young brother sussed this out. He saw what was happening. He could see them going, and so he got in before them, and he quit. And he went to another job. And his argument was, because he was new to the place, they weren't going to load a whole bunch of things on him. And so he played the system. But the net result is he couldn't stay in the job more than 3 or 4 years, because by 4 years you've got to be master of your job and they start to dump more on you, you see. So either way, whether they send you out the door after 5 years or whether you go out because you're too smart to stay put and have this done to you, whatever, you're not there for very long, you see. So you say, what's that got to do with the collegial things? Well, it has this to do with it. In a lot of places, people, because of this transitory nature of the job, they carry that attitude into the ecclesia as well. See, if you're only going to a town to pick up a job which you know is only the last 3 or 4 years, and it's going to take up a fair bit of your time while you're at it, because you're learning it, getting it on top of it, then you won't devote all that much time and attention to the ecclesia. And that is happening in a lot of places in the world. And I've found, you know, brethren talking about this, say, in the States. So brethren come in, they think, great, young families come in.
But they're not going to stay here very long, and while they're here, they're distracted with the job anyway and getting established. They know that no sooner get on top of it, and you think, great, now we get something out of them, and they're on to the next job, and they're somewhere else. And the net result is there's a lot more transitoriness in the ecclesia as a result of this aspect of the work scene. And I think that's something, again, that we ought to be aware of and think about. I guess it's happening in parts of South Africa. It's certainly happening in New Zealand. It's because of the market economy and the way they drive things. Now, I might have dressed it up a little bit. It might be quite as bad as it, as I painted it, but I think it's an issue that we need to think about. I'm going to be very quick about the last couple of three slides. Question that arises sometimes, a matter of conscience. Should we join the union? I don't know whether unionism is compulsory in this country. It isn't now. Maybe this is a non-issue. But union activity, a lot of it's okay, in my opinion, but... there are some problems with unions, and I think we've just got to just be aware of it, especially with our young people, so that we can think about it. The union claims to be the source of improvements in working conditions and salary, and a fair bit of pressure can get on us if we go into the suitable that kind of workplace to join, because if we don't, we're regarded as freeloaders, and none of us like to be thought of as freeloaders. And I think one of the things which we need to take into account is to just watch the union methods. They're flatly opposed by Jesus' teaching. And at least in New Zealand, membership of the union obliges us to do what the majority says. And you know, the majority has never been right in scriptural things. John mentioned that the other day. The broad gate and the broad way. I won't discuss any more about unions because I can see that people say, no, you don't have to join it here. You've got an option. You probably want to look at the option. I think there's quite a bit more that could be said about it, but we won't. The last thing I'm going to say, because my time is up, is just to speak about retirement. I'm now blessed to be in that crowd. Actually, we had a very hot summer in New Zealand, and I was working on study, and about mid-afternoon, Coral would say to me, why don't we go for a swim? You know, we don't have a pool in our backyard or anything like that, so we get in the car and drive to the local beach. And it was quite an interesting experience for us as a newly retired couple to go to the beach at 1:30 or 2:00 in the afternoon. We joked about it, said we joined the Roly Poly Club because there were all the other retirees out on the beach having a swim, and when the schools come out and the beaches start getting inhabited, they all vanish. So you only see them in the middle of the afternoons there, you know. If the Lord doesn't return very soon, every one of us in our jobs is going to retire sooner or later. A lot of my colleagues have no idea what they're going to do with their retirement. They dread the idea that they're going to retire because they've lived to work. And when the work dries up, as sure as anything it is going to, there's nothing more certain than the fact you're going to quit work one day. You say, oh boy, I love it. But you've actually got to think, what are you going to do about it? My colleagues, they don't know what they're going to do. A lot of them, they have no idea. They say, one fellow says he's going to sit at home all day and watch television. Can you imagine it? Another fellow says he's going to play golf all the day. Well, that, to me, is just as bad as watching television. Worse, perhaps. Because it involves a bit of random activity. But what are you going to do with your retirement? And how can we prepare during our working life for a fruitful retirement? And what sort of job are we going to choose that's going to take us to that point? Because, you see, now we have this wonderful opportunity to be able to do just whatever the Lord has in mind for us to do. And the job has prepared us for this to some extent. It hasn't been the job that I would have chosen most of all, but at least I could stand up and put my hands in my pocket and chat about a few things, which I mightn't be able to do if I'd been, I don't know, whatever. Bus driver. But so the job is useful, and I think that we can all use it some way or another. Brother in our meeting has a degree in accounting, and when he just naturally looks after the accounts and so on, and he uses those skills and the truth and so on. there's an interesting thing about the parable of the talents. It's going to be very brief, but you know that the parable of the talents has a picture of the judgment. And what happens is that in this life, talents are given out, and they are talents that are given out. I know this is some of money, but it represents abilities and things, talents. And then the judgment comes. Now, what's interesting to notice is what happens to the talents. The servants come, and the one who had five talents and has made another five, or whatever, he gets to receive the talents that were originally given. They were loaned to him at first, but not only the original loan, but also the increase are given to him, and he carries that away from this performance review, to use a word for term, which is actually the judgment. He carries it away. Now, where does he go? Well, after the judgment, where do you go? You go into the kingdom. Right? What's it telling you? It's telling you that the talents that you have now and the opportunities which you use to exploit those talents, plus the increase that you gain on the way, you're going to carry into the kingdom, which is another way of saying that what you do now may actually be relevant and useful in the kingdom. Right? Well, retirement is in a small measure, a kind of a picture of that, I believe. And so we ought to think about our working lives with that idea in mind, that we may have the opportunity one day to use this. Is it useful? And if not, how can we make it useful? Because it's going to one day finish up in the kingdom, right? And superannuation, very quickly. I've got to stop, I really do. Mind you, I think we started a little late. But superannuation, I started superannuation with this idea in mind. I thought, sure as anything, the Lord's going to be back on the earth before I ever draw cent one of the super scheme. But I know that I'm a lousy saver. So to have a little bit of backstop for the family, I invest in the superannuation fund. Well, that is a gold mine now. That is just magic. Because you see, at age 53, I retired from work, worked part-time until the end of last year. At age 57, I quit. And we're not living in luxury, but we're living. And the paycheck comes in, and I don't have to give a thought. Now, I know all things can change, and that may not last, and I'm not relying on it. I mean, it's the Lord's provision. But boy, that was the best investment I ever made in terms of the world's things. Because now we can live. And I would say that, you know, we ought to, if we have the opportunity to think about that, because now is a good time to make preparation. Early retirement gives the opportunity for doing what Brother John, Sister Anne are doing, Sister Coral and I in our small way, and many, many other retirees go and do some work for the Lord in our mission work, if we're asked to do it. I mean, we don't just impose ourselves on it, but if there's an opportunity, let's be very ready to take it. You know, I think that's good. So, develop skills that can be used in the truth. That's the message. And I mean, there's a whole lot more that I have in my notes. I have pages and pages of notes on it. Self-employed. I'm not in a position where I can really say about, talk about self-employed, because I've never been self-employed. I chose not to, and I can see that it's got pluses and minuses and so on. There's lots of things that we could discuss and which are valuable to discuss. And those who are better qualified than I will be pleased to share their experience. I'm sure that Brother Mike would talk about that if you were to approach him about it. His perspective on it and his wisdom and accumulated experience. So there's just a few thoughts about focusing on the truth in relation to work. Thank you very much.